This is Roger Corman, and you're listening to Film Wax Radio.
Everybody, Adam Shartoff here, host of Film Wax Radio, episode number 439. Happy Halloween to everybody. This is a very fun episode for any fans of horror films, the horror film genre. For a number of years now, Larry Fessenden, who is a regular guest on this podcast, along with his colleague Glenn McQuaid, a horror film filmmaker himself, they have been producing a series of audio plays, many live, some in the studio of this series called Tales from Beyond the Pale. You can find them at talesfrombeyondthepale.com. They're wonderful. They're at once extraordinarily contemporary, even though they kind of nod to radio plays of the past. And they fit comfortably today. You know, the rebirth of audio. Audio has become an enormous thing, thanks in large part to me and my podcast. Okay, that's not necessarily true, but why not take credit? So on this episode, what we're doing is we're celebrating the release of the fourth installment of Tales from Beyond the Pale. It is currently available as a digital download or in physical media package format, which you can order. And we're going to talk about that. We have a bunch of people on this episode. Some are there in the room. Some are call-ins. And they include, of course, Larry Fessenden back, I think, for his fourth visit. We have Glenn McQuaid. We have also in the room Clay McLeod Chapman, who's a contributing writer to a number of the tales from Beyond the Pale. Also contributing writer April Snelling's calling in from Knoxville, Tennessee. She's calling in. And also the actress Barbara Crampton, who has been in at least a couple of the past productions of Tales from Beyond the Pale. So this was done in the Glass Eye Picks office in the East Village, which is where I think we did my last segment with Larry and his son when they were on earlier in the year. So here we go with that. So we'll just do this in time for Halloween, since they are all interested in things macabre. Here we go with my conversation with Larry, Glenn, Clay, April, and Barbara. And then we'll just call it a show after that. No outro on this episode, folks. Back in a couple of days with a brand new episode of Film Wax Radio. Thanks very much. Let's go into this wonderful conversation about Tales from Beyond the Pale.
Glad you've decided to join us on our little journey to the City of Angels.
Here it comes. Can't stop it. Don't want to stop it.
Jack, let go. I just want to go back down to the hotel.
Well, that's certainly not something you see every day.
Where's Jesus?
He's real busy.
Hey, get your hands off me!
Do you know they all laugh at you?
Big nose, sniffing around.
You're Clifford's boy, ain't you? You got your daddy's name.
One arcane death spell.
Daddy's gone. They bit through his leg and they were all over him.
So let's set it up here. We're in the offices of Glass Eye Picks, everybody. Here on a cool early fall day, all gathered together, us folks, and back for his 18th visit on the podcast.
That's true.
And we're going to talk about season 4 of Tales from Beyond the Pale. It is now officially out there.
Yes, Friday the 13th was our release date. It was a mad scramble
to make that date happen.
We managed. So we're very excited. It's available on Audible and Amazon and through our website, TalesFromBeyondThePale.com.
Congratulations on that. Four seasons. That's quite a huge deal. Four seasons, right?
It is for us.
Larry, you kind of started this with Glenn McQuaid, who's joining us also. Hi, Glenn. Welcome. Finally.
Hey,
finally.
Yep. Good to be here.
Yeah.
Sorry.
I'm doing good. I feel finally I have some closure. We've been planning your visit for a while.
Yeah, nice to be on here. Thanks for having us.
Okay. And you two together, right? Did you guys start Tales from Beyond the Pale together as a creative team?
I feel like
team?
Many years ago. Much simpler times. Right? When was it? I don't know, maybe 2000 and... Well, when was Stakeland being... When was Stakeland made? Because the decision was made to go beyond the pale on a journey up to meet Jim Mickle as he was making Stakeland.
He was on the show once.
Yeah, he's a lovely chap. Yeah. And Larry and I and Jack Fessenden were all listening to an old Inner Sanctum radio show. And it was just like, oh my God. At the time, not too many people, certainly no one we knew, were making audio dramas. So there's quite a few more now. But at the time, it just seemed like such a crazy, wild, bananas idea to look at something from the past, like radio plays, and see if we could bring them into what was then the present.
Yeah. And, you know, we've done a lot of anthology stuff. I mean, Glass Eye is sort of about anthologies, which is to say to build a community of like-minded artists and get them to work on their films and, you know, see what we can do to support that. And as a result, we always had that instinct to gather people, and we knew a lot of filmmakers, and we thought, well, maybe some of these filmmakers have scripts that haven't been produced yet that would work in the audio format. So we got J.T. Petty, Paul Sollett, Graham Resnick.
Simon Rumley,
much to our shock and horror.
Yes.
A lot of filmmakers, and we said, do you want to do a half-hour drama? And a lot of them jumped at the chance. And some of them, the first season, some of them did it without our tutelage. We would often... look at the
really?
Scripts, yeah,
okay.
And then they would produce them. In particular, Simon, he produced his in the UK, and he sent it to us. And it was the first one Glenn and I listened to.
The first completed Tales from Beyond the Pale, and we were horrified. It's a very good piece, but if you know Simon Rumley's work, he does really play with some risque tropes. Simon Rumley made a movie called Red, White, and Blue. Before that, The Living and the Dead, and most recently, Fashionista.
Okay.
So he's a pretty extreme filmmaker. So, and British and Proud, which is his piece, is probably one of the most extreme audio dramas I had ever heard.
I think I had Simon on two.
Oh, yeah.
Which is, he's very I think
charming.
We did it from.
Yeah, Simon's a great guy.
But deadly. Charming,
yeah.
But deadly. So that was a great introduction. That's when Glenn and I realized we had our hands full.
I apologize. First of all, at this point, we should bring in Clay McLeod Chapman, who is also now a contributing writer of some of the episodes.
Yeah. I kind of piggybacked in season two. So thanks for having me.
Oh, my pleasure. I'm glad to finally meet you.
I would love to tell the story of how Clay got involved, because it's quite charming.
Let's go to that in a second. I just wanted to first respond to you started allowing people to work independently, and then you tied them together, right, ultimately, in these compilations.
Well, it was sort of a mix, I would say.
I mean, mostly coming out of New York, and we would have someone like JT come into the studio, and we'd be there, and we'd really be actively producing. Simon was just a funny example, because it was the first completed tale, and it was shipped to us. There was one other that was done remotely, which
Jeff
was...
So the majority was...
Yeah.
The majority of the plays were done... Well, you guys were hands-on involved.
Very much.
Exactly.
Okay, and you would record them where?
At Digit Audio, which is
where?
Now... Digit Audio.
Digit Audio?
Which is in on Howson Street and Varick. It's
okay.
Only recently moved and turned into Red Hook Post. Is that right? But our friend Tom Effinger, we've done 20 movies there or something over the years, so we got him involved, and it was great. And that was studio-based, and then we build the sound effects. We'd even have a Foley artist. And as I say, we had two of them done remotely, three of them actually. Paul Sollett did his also in L.A. So the point is that was the most... that whole season was built very carefully in the studio, and some of
the Okay, so essentially that's the way you've worked since. I mean, you essentially did all of it, you collaborate all together.
I think with season two in particular, they were all live one performance shows. And I think that was, we were so enamored by what we'd managed to pull together for season one. We were like, well, how do we push it a little further? And we thought, well, let's try to do these things live. And so season two, all the pieces on there were performed one time only in New York City. And season four, they're all, again, live one time only shows, which were recorded actually in Montreal, Colorado, and Los Angeles.
Terrific. But the season two was a very cozy experience because Clay used to do a show at Dixon Place.
Oh, yeah. And that's downtown in the Chinatown, Lower East Side area.
Fearmongers.
Yeah. It was sort of a talk show with members of the community who were into horror in one way or another, authors and so on. And he was about to have a kid, and he realized he just couldn't handle his usual monthly obligations.
Sure, yeah.
So he said, do you guys want to take over the theater in my slot? So this was just an immensely perfect opportunity for Tales. So we did two shows every, whatever it was, Wednesday of October of that year.
It was a Tuesday, actually.
It was a Tuesday.
We'll see you next Tuesday.
And it was very charming, and we had some great actors, Vincent D'Onofrio. Good Lord, the mind goes blank.
Mark Margolis.
And a lot of our usual crew, as well as who was in Crush, the most beloved?
Sean Young. In Crush, which is sort of a southern gothic piece set in a vineyard. And we have our own troupe of actors that we like to go back to, local guys like John Spiridakis and Matt Huffman and
James LeGros
in quite a few as well, so... A real community we've built up, not just with the writer directors that we bring in, like Clay, but also just the actors. And when we go out to Colorado, for instance, we've done two shows there years apart, but we've gone back to the same actors out there as well.
I went to a live recording at the Walter Reed last year. I think it was a year, maybe a year and a half ago, correct? And
yeah,
that was a lot of fun. And and I have a compilation I've listened to. There is a nostalgic nod, though, to the old timey radio plays. It's, in other words, I think audio plays and storytelling in general, with podcasting, with the kind of storytelling as an approach, and podcasting, all the rest is clearly the audio is a big deal now at the moment. But you're. Most of that doesn't necessarily mean that they're looking back towards this other time. You're paying homage, on some level, to that early stage where people gathered around and watched the radio.
Well, we always like to say that we're not sort of pursuing that quaint old-timey vibe. I think it's built in. And also, we're telling scary stories, which have a certain sweetness to it. But we really try to have very immersive sound effects and bring it into the modern vernacular. And also push the audience to work a little harder instead of saying, well, I'm going to go down the hall, clip-clop, clip-clop.
Which we have done. I could swear that the hall clip-clop came up at least once or twice.
But, some of them we really pushed the envelope.
Yeah.
Glenn did a tale called, what is it,
The Ripple at Cedar Lake?
Ripple at Cedar Lake, which is worth checking out. That's a multi-dimensional experience in which there are many simultaneously existing plateaus of time. Anyway, and then I've done one where the last 10 minutes, this house is shape-shifting and you just hear people yelling and screaming. So
its shape is shifting.
I think the nostalgia is going to be there with us personally, in a way, because we do love our hearts. I mean, certainly my heart goes back to the old Universal movies and the old Hammer horrors. So I think that's always going to be part of anything that I'm doing. But with Tales from Beyond the Pale, I've tried to avoid it being a reference or a revival show because a reference to the past, because so many audio drama shows out there are just they're basically just doing the older plays. They're reviving stuff that was written in the 40s and stuff. So definitely feel like audio drama is a pretty vital, can be a vital storytelling format. So we've really pushed ourselves in a way to sort of explore that and see what new things we can get out of it.
Well, yeah, I should have mentioned also in that pathetic list I was trying to scrape together before of the audio media, books on audiobooks are pretty big business, I would think.
Yeah.
So why not original content meant for audio, not something that was meant for the written word that was adapted into, you know?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I think a lot of money is made in audiobooks, and they're produced quite easily, you know. It's one actor on a mic, you know.
Yeah, so exactly. They don't go for the special effects and locations and all that.
So in a way, it's just it really is a different beast, you know. And certainly, the live shows in which sometimes we've got like 17 or 18 people on stage, musicians,
yes,
actors, yeah, Foley artists, ourselves, and a couple of friends, and you know, getting all of that—it's much more like theater in a way.
It really is. I would say
the closest thing to getting back to theater that I've ever done. So
yeah,
they really are different beasts.
Yeah. And we also use canned sound effects and pre-recorded sound effects. Mm-hmm. Very often, we'll do stuff and record on location and bring it into the computer and play it.
Holdigger had 100%.
Well, it was all from the location where the thing had happened, based on recordings. True tale.
I gotta catch up.
The idea there is, you know, we're not trying to do everything with Foley, you know. Although we do have a wind machine, but it's also fun to have. That's the thing in terms of having sort of a more realistic vibe at times. So, walked in. He made
Jeff. How you doing?
It's Adam.
He's been on the podcast.
Yes, about scores.
Jeff scored to death.
Composed the theme song,
which
we used, and he acting, writing, and also Foley.
I will never forget the time we got you on stage to do Foley, and you were like, never again.
Yeah. Clay, have you gotten back to Dixon Place into your regular slot again, or are you?
No. I mean,
fatherhood is just.
Yeah, I'm a full time father.
Are you got one kid or
two?
Yeah,
I had a sequel. You know, I'll be frank and say that, you know, the Fearmongers event that I hosted was basically an opportunity to kind of ingratiate myself with the people that I admired and looked up to, like Larry and Glenn. So it was honestly just a ruse to get them to work with me, and it worked. So I think, frankly, like, you know, it was a wonderful time, an opportunity to kind of, segue into, you know, collaborative efforts, and here we are. Gosh, what, like 5 years later?
I guess it's 5 years. I can't keep track.
I don't know.
But you've written 3 or 4 pieces? Father, like son?
I feel like I can lay claim to at least 2 and then helped out with 2 others. But I did like Father, Like Son for season 2.
Which was live.
And then for season 4, Mattress King. Both starring Larry, and then I helped out with the Tales We Tell.
Tales We Tell,
parts one and two.
All in season 4. Very exciting.
All in season 4 which is now available. Where can people buy the physical product? It's got this graphic component to it. It's got a book in it. In other words, it's really. It's beautiful, and you guys pay obviously a lot of attention. You have real designers working with you.
Yeah.
So pick at the product, man.
I would encourage people to go to our website. It's lovely, and but you can buy the product there. You can also buy the MP3s there as well. Right. The MP3s are of a higher quality than most of the other streaming sites as well. So
Did you say that? Is it going to? Am I going to get in trouble since I'm on iTunes? But they're compressing even more so.
I think a lot of places compress a little further than what we have on our website.
Okay.
So, Again, if you love us, everything that you spend on the website goes directly back into Tales from Beyond the Pale. So I would encourage everyone to go spend all of their money.
Make more and more tales.
Yes, I mean, that's the goal.
Vicious cycle.
We now have 38 tales.
42,
but... Oh. We have 38 released, 42 made. What's that? That's about 21 hours of audio content.
You're somewhat into season 5?
Well, there's talk of a season 5, but the most recent live shows we've yet to release, and that's at the Lincoln Center. We did a piece. Also did a double bill at the Overlook Film Festival.
Oh, right. That had its first season.
Actually starring Clay and Larry. Yep.
Yeah. Yes. So good one.
Was it?
Yes, there were flying goblins attacking a gondola.
And a plane crash.
All there on stage?
Yes, I mean, this is the thing we like to say about Tales. It's much cheaper to make entertainment without paying for cameras and lights.
Costume.
And travel. So, Tales have a very diverse setting, often, and the ambition and and the costumes. It's all left to the imagination.
Yeah, this is terrific. I know that we have, from a couple of tales, I assume, a couple of actors, although another contributing writer, April Snellings.
Yes.
We're going to call, momentarily. And also actress, of course, people know her from her fabulous decades-long career, the actress Barbara Crampton as well.
And, yes.
Who's been in a number of classics, to say the least.
She texted me and says she's standing by.
Oh, she's standing by.
She's wonderful, and we were lucky enough when we... go to these remote film festivals and stuff, we find out who might be visiting the festival, and then we write around that in anticipation that they'll be able to join us on stage for our tale. So we happened to learn that Barbara was going to be at this one festival, and we contacted her, and she did the live show. However, I guess we really met her because we did a tale with Stuart Gordon, the great filmmaker who made Reanimator. And he had Barbara aboard, and that was one of the times we did.
It was for
the studio,
The Hound, on season 3, and all of the season 3 tales are recorded in the studio. Which, when you do these things live, you realize what a luxury it is to have things like takes.
Well, believe me, as an actor, you realize that we massage these tales afterwards and we get them up to speed for the presentation. But the one thing is that the performances are all one take live.
The live thing, of course, right. Although you could technically redo it, right? I mean,
well, I could, but we can hardly gather all these actors. That's part of the charm. We have the strangest people like Martin Starr and
of course.
Joshua Leonard, all sorts of people who are basically available only in their hometown. So it would seem also to be cheating.
Well, yes. So in other words, being in the recording studio is the rehearsals for the live event, in a sense, right? So by the time you get there, you're pretty well...
No, because that's another thing. Glenn and I are extremely stubborn. We've never repeated a tale.
So the live events are brand new as well?
The live ones, we're lucky if we rehearse once on the day.
Wow.
And then we do it that night.
Uh-huh.
And the studio ones, someone comes in and does their bit, but of course you can do several takes. Mm-hmm. So that's sort of the routine.
Okay. And so what do you do with the live ones? Do those get onto the compilations as well?
Well, season 4 is, they're all live. We just
These are the ones from all the live shows. Okay, now I got it.
Yeah, same as season 2. So what we'll do is we'll have a sound engineer, Lee Nussbaum, does a lot of our live mixing, and he'll record... all of the channels separately, so we can then, months, sometimes maybe a year later, bring it all into Pro Tools and really clean them up. There's a lot of work that needs to be done to these pieces. For instance, we can have 17 mics on stage. Often one mic is getting the sound from another bleeding into it, so we go in and meticulously clean everything up. And sometimes
it seems almost impossible to isolate 17 mics.
Sometimes we'll then embellish some of the sound design and pump up the music and stuff.
And of course, master them. Add the applause.
Exactly.
And the laughter.
Actually, that's one thing I've been meaning to do with the live ones. We should have a mic directed at the audience, because it's usually just from the bleed from the Foley mics that we're getting the laughter and the applause. You know,
and it is funny. There's just a couple of them in season four where you just hear a little chortle from the audience.
Yeah.
It's fun to hear what people react to.
Yeah. Should we give Barbara a call? Or
what
do you want?
Glenn, do you have access to her number?
Barbara Crampton?
Yeah.
Yeah, hang on a second.
She sent me a picture of a ghost indicating that she's standing by. I mean, I can find
if she sent you a picture, then you must have her number.
Alright, I will.
And there's April Snellings as well. The phone's off.
Yeah. That might be. I mean, we could put them both on speakers, but that could get even more.
Is this an intermission? Is
it right? It can be. Anytime. Yeah, jump in.
More sound effects.
Yeah, that sounds good. Let me just.
Hello?
Let's put it right up against.
Barbara, we're here. It's Larry and Glenn.
Hi.
And
hi.
Clay.
Hi,
and
guys. How are you?
Our host, Adam.
Well, okay. So now we're introducing the actor, Barbara Crampton. My name's Adam, and I guess this is my.
Oh,
look at that.
Hi, Barbara.
There's Glenn.
Hi. All right.
There's your friend Larry.
Hi, darling.
Hi, everybody.
Hi, Barbara.
And there's Clay contributing.
Hi.
Now you've met everybody.
Hi.
So, Barbara, how many times have you collaborated with Larry? Do you remember?
Well, you know, technically we were in Your Next together, but I didn't meet Larry on that movie. And then we did We Are Still Here together, and that's when I first met the brilliant genius man that he is and worked with him and got to watch him die a famous death in that movie. And
he's good at that.
I was forever a fan after that.
Did you, you're next? That one?
No, we
Are Still Here.
Ted's film. Yeah. Ted Kahigan's film.
Ted's film,
right, Ted. And I think Larry choked on a sock or something. I can't remember exactly. But.
Choked on the sock, and then he took a fireplace poker and murdered himself with it. And
oh, right.
Self in the eye.
Yeah. Well, I'm very excited to have you on the podcast, Barbara. Thank you.
Oh, I'm happy to be here. Thank you, guys.
Where are you right now, roughly? You don't have to give an exact street address.
I'm in Northern California. I live just north of the Golden Gate Bridge in Frick County, and I'm about 30 miles away from where all the fires were.
Oh, I'm glad you didn't have trouble then. Good.
We didn't have the trouble. We have some refugees in our town right now, and I've been helping out a little bit with that. But the nice thing is there's so many people in our area willing to help. You try to show up at a shelter to sign up for a shift, and they're all filled, and nobody can do anything because everybody else is helping. So it's really wonderful how the communities come together.
It's great.
Well, it's not like the president's going to do anything. All right, let's see.
No,
I don't mean to bring.
He hasn't even mentioned us. He hasn't even mentioned us.
No, I know.
We don't need him.
Nah, no. I'm just looking. So you're in season four of Tales from Beyond the Pale.
Yay!
How was that?
It's wonderful. I mean, you know, I've done two of these now, and I really enjoyed. Being a part of a sort of a lost art, you know,
yeah.
It's kind of like a radio drama, and it was pretty thrilling to, you know, perform live, especially with this one, because you know, I'm used to stopping and somebody giving me some direction and doing another take, and we had just one sort of read through kind of rehearsal where we talked about the material and then we just kind of went with it. So it was a pretty thrilling experience to just be there in the moment. And, you know, all the people that worked on it, I trusted. So I felt really comfortable doing it. But I was also a little bit nervous because we're not used to performing live once we made the move into the movie business. But, yeah, I used to do that when I was in college.
Oh.
I was in a lot of theater and I lived in New York City for a year before I moved out to Los Angeles, and so I was used to doing that. But
you mean live acting?
Live, yeah.
Yeah, but does it require a different set of acting muscles to do audio play than it would? I mean, does it take you out of your comfort zone as an actor?
Oh yeah, it totally did. Yeah, I was you know, I mean, I've mentioned this before, I was, my heart was beating really fast, and I was sweating, you know, I was totally, totally nervous, and the thing is, when we did this recording at the Stanley Film Festival, a lot of my peers were in the audience, you know, not the least of which was Stuart Gordon, so,
wow.
I felt under the microscope.
It's worth saying that Barbara has a 6-page monologue at the tail end.
No, that's not true. Barbara has a 15-page monologue.
You keep saying
it's
that.
It's 15
it
pages.
Really?
It is. So. It's. We gave you a lot to work on there. But you were absolutely wonderful in the piece.
Do you still have to memorize the script, more or less, even though you're allowed to, you're referring to it, right?
All of the actors have the script on stage with them, so that's actually one thing that we're happy to for the actors, the ability to just read and not worry about learning lines.
Well, but you still have to act. You still have to. You're interacting with other actors.
Well, I mean, you get familiar with the script, and one thing we always say to the actors is that the Foley artists are their physical performance. So to really just enjoy that strange interaction of saying the words and having the physical movements disembodied in a way.
I mean, the funny thing is, we always say, act to the microphone. The tradition, in acting is that you, of course, turn to your actor, look them in the eye, react, interact. But in this case, you really are using just the audio. And so you're in this weird world and you're picturing the other person, even though they're right there. It's a very unique thing, and you have to remind everyone in that one rehearsal to get into that headspace.
So,
and I didn't memorize any of my dialogue or anything, but I worked with the script, you know, pretty extensively, and everybody has their own way of doing things, but I usually mark my script up, you know, and for something like this, I marked it up a lot, you know, what's the operative word in the sentence?
Yes.
Where am I going to take a pause?
Yeah.
Where does the energy change? Just different things like that. I use little notations for things, and that helped me a lot.
Right. Makes sense. It's sort of like, the more I think about it, it's like halfway between almost, I don't know, like singing or, I don't know, it's a different, it's a whole different performative art. That's for sure.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, and you know what, like Larry was saying, like acting to the microphone, I kept, you know, that was my first time doing it. These guys have done it before, but I found myself like looking up and looking at Larry sometimes and seeing what he was doing. And then I went, oh, I got to get back to the microphone. I mean, that was definitely present in my mind because he had said that. And you know, I was just bringing myself back all the time. But also, you know, as an actor, you are trying to create something. You know, you're acting to the microphone, but you're trying to create a vivid imagination for your viewer to think about in their mind. And also I was seeing it in my mind, even though Larry was next to me and I'm looking at the microphone, but you know, in my head, I'm also as hope the listeners are seeing a picture in their head. I'm seeing a picture in my head too, as we're going through the piece.
It's almost like the music analogy I was trying to make.
Uh-huh.
It almost kind of works. I'm thinking like a staged opera or something, only because you were talking about almost like you were writing your notes on your script, like almost like you're working out the phrasing, and you know, and your relationship is with the mic. So in some ways, and it's orchestrated like that. So
in a way, they feel like scrappy rock and roll shows as well, especially all of the pieces on season 4, because we were on the road for them, you know, and we don't have a lot of time.
Right.
For instance, with Cold Reading, we had the luxury of time with the actors the morning of the show and then a little bit again right before the show. But there's a lot involved. There's musicians, Foley artists, ourselves. And so in a way, it can feel like A bit rock and roll, you know?
You arrive in town with your suitcases filled with equipment. You unpack all these mics. You got all these cords. Everybody, yeah. You got to plug it all in and see if it's going to work. Then you do a sound check, and then you're on. I mean, it really is like a traveling rock show. It's fun.
I think what's fun about these live shows as well, in particular for the live audience, is that they can close their eyes for it, and then they will get their own full-on visual of what we're doing. And I sort of encourage ourselves, like when we're directing on stage, to be super casual and sort of walking around a little bit and just pulling back the curtain on the process of what goes into creating an audio drama. So I think there's a nice juxtaposition there when you close your eyes for a few minutes and can really be transported into the stories that we're telling, and then open them to see us how we're putting it all together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, on season two in particular, just because we had a sense of that stage, we would encourage the director to walk around, and if he wants to sort of say, you know, encourage the actor to maybe speed things up, or he goes over to the Foley and say, "And now go." So you really are able, it's like you're watching a conductor.
Yeah, that's what I was
thinking. Again, back to the music analogy.
Yeah, there is.
And then that's the whole point. And it's funny, some people come to these and they're ready to be performative. And we always say, no, that just do whatever you want with the script. And just as long as you're working with the audio, you can, it's very casual. We're just watching a process unfold. And that sort of is part of the charm.
Clay, let's bring you into this conversation. Once the script is done, are you done with it, or are you involved as you're preparing the audio plays to maybe have changes or still developing anything?
Well, Larry and Glenn, I think, value the writer almost to a fault. I was kind of thrown in to be the director of my own piece and having, you know, little to no experience as a director and working with actors on stage, it was interesting to be kind of become a conductor to a symphony that we construct. And, you know, I do think that there is almost two performances happening at the same time. There's one for the audience, the live audience, and then one for the listener, you know, months down the road.
Right.
And, you know, luckily there's a kind of mind's eye towards the energy that the audience gives the performer. I think a lot of the live shows have a certain, there's an electricity to the performances because the actors are in front of a live audience.
Yeah, they're getting the energy is reciprocal. It's coming in, it is very reciprocal.
And very
sure. As a writer, too, often I imagine that someone who's a novelist or even a nonfiction, what have you, specifically fiction, I guess, or even maybe a screenwriter, playwright, that you're visualizing, you know, the characters and the story. And this is something where I wonder if you're visual, you still are visualizing it, I assume, right, as you're writing it, even though it's going to actually just be an audio performance.
Yeah. That's funny, yeah.
It's kind of interesting.
I feel like the thing that I was harking back to is the kind of Orson Welles War of the Worlds understanding of you're creating a moment that you want to feel is contained, but also there's something alive about it. So the notion that whatever the story may be, whatever the radio play may be, it feels like almost like a butterfly in a glass jar. There's something to be kind of uncapped and re-experienced. So it feels very palpable, alive to me. And that's what the kids are doing these days. Like podcasts, I think we're kind of doing the digital War of the Worlds or the kind of current Orson Welles style radio show with podcasts.
Yeah.
One thing I want to say about, and I think Glenn and I do it, and other directors come at it in a different way. You all discover your mode, but one thing I enjoy is that I still lay it out like a movie, and there are these close-ups, and they're wide shots. For example, in one of my plays called The Hole Digger, they make breakfast, and you just hear the sizzle of bacon, and then you can tell it's a cut, like an Edgar Wright movie. He made Shaun of the Dead. and then you hear the toast coming up, and then you hear the plates going down, and you realize you've just experienced three fast visual close-ups. So, and then Glenn and I, we often use, you know, if there's a car, you'll have a scene inside the car and the talking and the dialogue, and then suddenly you'll just be outside, and from left to right in your headphones, if you listen that way, goes by, and you realize you've just cut to an exterior. So it's funny, I still use basically cinematic language, and that's part of my enjoyment, is I feel I'm creating pictures.
I think as I write them, it's a very visual experience. And as they go out there to listeners, what's intriguing about it is they bring their own vision. They really do bring their own visuals to these pieces.
Yeah.
And that's what's probably most powerful about the format, is that it's interactive in that sense. But I wrote Trawler very visual. I wrote Cold Reading with April Snellings. I mean, it was a very, very big and important part of the process to visualize and see the world and atmosphere and tone, and to be able to visualize these locations and these characters. It's a wonderful trick. For instance, we recorded Speaking in Tongues in Montreal, and Larry plays an older gentleman who turns out to be kind of a huckster demon. And a young guy in the audience, who had his eyes open the entire time, was enjoying the show, drew a picture of Larry's character and gave it to us at the end of the show, and it was this old Peter Cushing style character. It was beautiful to get that kind of feedback.
Made itself into the graphic novel.
But yeah, we even put that in the book.
His drawing?
Yeah, it's just,
is that his? Oh, that's
so he drew that live.
Oh, that young guy there.
Yeah.
Oh, that's great.
Anyway, it was very fun.
Oh, I see. I can see the Peter Cushing. He kind of looks like the artist too, but
yeah. Well, these things happen.
Barbara.
Yeah.
Appreciate you again. Thank you for doing this. Anything else you want to add, or that I didn't ask?
Oh, geez, I don't know.
No, it's my job to ask you the questions. I shouldn't ask you to come up with them, for gosh sake. Or is there going to be...
That's kind of your job.
Yeah, exactly. Put me in my place before I put me in my place. Are you going to do another one of these, should the request come? Of course you are, right? You love working with Larry and Glenn.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I almost did one with them at another festival, but at the last minute I had to cancel my time at the festival. I couldn't go, but...
As I recall, Barbara, we saw you had skiing photos. pretended you had an important place to be, and then we saw you skiing and gallivanting on the slopes.
Don't mind him, Barbara. He's very happy because he ended up playing the role that was going towards you.
Oh, that's true. I got the role.
You did, Larry. You played that role?
Yes, darling. Just so you know, I'm nipping at your heels.
It was this All About Eve moment.
That's funny. Actually, I think I had come off a night shoot on a movie, and then I had the flu. I didn't feel well, and I was like, I just couldn't go. I was really, sorry. I was really, and the skiing, you know, I just felt better all of a sudden.
That's okay.
So, I love doing them, and the only time I've ever done it is with you guys, and I don't know anybody else that's doing what you're doing. I mean, I think it's just...
Not as well.
Yeah. You know,
well, they haven't been on this podcast.
That's true.
Well, it was pretty thrilling and amazing. So, you know, any other time you guys want me to do one, I would do it in a heartbeat.
That's
really
the correct answer. Very good
answer.
Now you can move on to the big money round. thank you for playing. You'll have a nice consolation prize. No, you win. You won, though, so you don't need a consolation prize. Thank you very much.
Okay. Bye, Barbara.
Thanks so much, Barbara.
Okay, bye.
Cheerio.
Enjoy the rest of your day.
Bye.
So we get April Snellings, who's also a contributing writer to some of the segments.
Sure. Do you have the right thing?
This is the word.
She sent you her phone number.
And she's in. She's in Tennessee.
Yes.
She's like in eastern
outside,
Tennessee, rather
outside of Knoxville.
Knoxville, Tennessee, which is right by the North Carolina border, I believe.
Yeah, and
shut off my
April wrote. Co-wrote Cold Reading and... The one that Barbara's in, and Speaking in Tongues, which is the one with the drawing from Montreal.
Oh, very good.
And she also wrote a piece for season 3, which is called Food Chain, and Larry directed that.
And that's Beloved. That's a really zany one. Here, you do that.
Good, no, good sound effects.
Hello?
April, it's Larry and Glenn and Clay and Adam, our host.
Four of my very favorite guys. How are y'all doing?
You smooth character, you. Here's Adam.
I get that a lot.
Are you in Knoxville, Tennessee? Did I see that on your face?
I'm in Oak Ridge, so I'm very close. I'm about 30 minutes outside Knoxville.
I know, 30 minutes here in New York is like... That's another state or another whole part of the country for us New Yorkers. But 30 minutes outside Knoxville is... So you must be west.
Yes, we're a driving folk. So, we drive everywhere we go. So, 30 minutes, nothing.
But west, right? Toward
just west. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yep. Because if you go 30 miles west, east, excuse me, you must hit the Blue Ridge Mountains.
Absolutely, yeah, or close to it. You know, you're going in that general direction.
Correct,
mm-hmm.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you too, Adam. Thank you for having us on.
Oh, my pleasure. And we just got off the phone with Barbara Crampton, and we were discussing actually her contribution, which is the one you wrote on, correct?
Yeah, I did, Glenn and I, with Cole Green, and she was terrific. She was just absolutely terrific. It was such a pleasure to, you know, I've been a fan of Barbara's for, a very long time now, and it was just incredible to get to work with her and to write things that she said. it was a lot of fun.
Can I ask, how did you meet Glenn and Larry and come to write, contribute to Tales from Beyond the Pale? And also, it seems as though you have an affection for the horror genre. Is that all safe to say? Or
it is, yeah. I've written for primarily Remorgue, but a lot of other horror magazines as well for years and years now. Not that many years, but for some years. And I interviewed Larry for, I don't even know, for something probably a couple of times. I've interviewed him for Remorgue, I know, and then for other mags, and got to know Glenn that way as well. Glenn and I share a lot of the same sort of enthusiasms for certain horror subgenres and films and TV shows, and we just became kind of fast friends. And when they asked me if I wanted to pitch some ideas for season three, I was, I would do nothing but pitch things for Tales for the rest of my life. It was fantastic.
I'm getting a visual now. Oh, Food Chain, April Snellings. Look at that.
Yeah.
Oh, and there you are. Of course, I can't see, but you're in between. You're being flanked by Larry and Glenn in a photo. There.
Excellent. Yes, that was a fun day. That's probably.
You're.
I would imagine. Which was that Food Chain that you're looking at, or was
yes, it is
that's Food Chain.
Bingo!
Oh, so there's man, what a great day! What a fun time that was.
Oh, and
that
Sean
was
Young
in studio.
Oh, right.
Tale and
yes,
very
season
complex.
Three.
Actually, a lot of action.
Uh-huh.
Which we've obviously done live, but it was particularly ambitious. Mm-hmm. April's story is fantastic, macabre. Mm-hmm.
It's
Big
wonderful.
Foot tale.
Whoever you guys got to play the Bigfoot.
Well, yes.
Fantastic.
Yeah,
well,
no Sean Young.
The real guy did.
What a missed opportunity.
Oh, yes. No. We went with the traditional male Bigfoot, Glenn played the role.
Okay.
It's anguished performance.
It was. I was in a really bad mood when we were recording.
I think you
recording.
Had your back spasms. Really
I had
paid
a backache,
off.
And I really channeled it. That was a great day. April came up to New York, actually stayed with me for about a week. We got into the studio with Sean and Larry and...
Jeremy Gardner,
Drew Moorline from VHS and Jason Yakow. It was a fun time.
It was terrific. The cast was great, and I wasn't quite sure what to expect. It was a very different experience than writing for magazines and being on the other end of horror for a change. And it was just terrific, man. We just had a blast.
How did it compare for you? How did the studio experience compare to doing one of these things live?
Oh gosh, I don't know. It was so different. I would say that there, it was somewhat less terrifying. But
being in the studio.
Yeah. There's, you know, you can do different takes, right? And you can make sure that everybody, you know, gets something that they're happy with. And then live, it's just a different energy. And you know, it's frightening, but also fun and really, man, what a rewarding experience that was when you guys somehow managed to pull off these live shows, and you do it over and over again. And I don't know how you handle the stress, but hey, it works.
It's a fun time. I remember at that show, I went up to Larry and I extended my little finger and told him to do the same, and we sort of clasped and snapped him, you know, which is an old theatre troupe thing from trope from Dublin when I was in the Dublin Youth Theatre. We used to do that a lot. Only Larry nearly broke my finger. I was in agony for the rest of the show.
Yes, there's a different tradition Larry comes from.
We just snap.
You snap that pinky right off that hand.
Come on, let's do this.
Have you guys met, Clay? Have you met April?
I was there at the Stanley Film Festival as well.
It's the Stanley Film Festival.
Yes. It was. Yes. It is no longer.
Oh, no longer
in Colorado in this ancient theater. So the atmosphere.
Where?
Was an ancient theater.
Where was it?
In Colorado.
Colorado.
Yeah, it was a lovely old theater in
was about to collapse.
In sort of the spring, but it was still cold. And this is the Stanley Hotel where Stephen King had stayed to write his novel.
That's not where the Overlook is.
No, that's the third iteration of the same festival, but now it's moved on to another
Timberline Lodge.
Yeah, another shining-oriented hotel.
Right.
What was funny about the old theater and the stage in Estes Park was that we were all on there practicing, and someone came in and said, there shouldn't be more than 8 people on that stage.
Yeah,
exactly. About 17 of us up there. We're like, okay.
Oh, the fire warden.
But it's worth saying that our ambition with this, I was very inspired by Glenn's tale and April's tale, Cold Reading, and so for some reason I got it into my head that we did two that night. And so I wrote mine, at the last minute, and so what I decided to do was sequelize his. So my tale called No Signal has Clay in it, and it presumes it's the premise is that it's 100 years later and they go to the same house, and as it unfolds you start to see that the same ghosts are there and the same sort of so it's fun, you know. Yeah. The audience gets this one wonderful sort of period piece, and then they have a very modern experience, but you start to make the connections and you realize it's the same haunted place. So we've had a lot of fun. These kind of strange things occur to us when we put the tales together. Very often Glenn and I are, you know, it really is like an assignment. You're staring at a blank page, and you know in 2 weeks you're going to be doing it live somewhere.
Yeah.
And you're going to have to gather all these sounds and create this entire world, and sometimes it's very intimidating. I have tremendous writer's block. Glenn, on the other hand, spits out the tale. He often writes 4 tales for a given assignment, and then he has to choose between them while I'm still typing out the first line.
When that's our brief, you know, we have to do something and it's coming up. We have 3 weeks' time to do it. I think it's a wonderful challenge, and there's just no time for writer's block. Just the fact alone, I mean, it's such a great place to be in to know. I mean, how rare is it to know that what you are now writing will most definitely be produced very quickly? You know, so you better be writing. It's helped. I've had writer's block in the past, but Tales has really, really helped me be a better and faster writer, sure.
I do agree.
Glenn, who is your muse?
His dog.
It's a good question.
Alfred, he's only 150 pounds of pure love.
Canine love.
I think in the past it probably might have been just the enjoyment of sipping a few whiskeys and writing away, that the kind of romantic idea of doing that. I know, but now I don't drink anymore, so I don't know. It's just fleeting things, you know, stuff I remember the first time I ever saw a horror movie or a scene from a horror movie, or just kind of...
Do you actually remember that?
Sometimes, you know, abstract kind of...
abstract, an abstract sort of visual or something will come to me, or and I'll try and channel that. You mm-hmm. know?
Also, for some of the these live shows where we know we're traveling to LA, we were invited there by Spectrevision, Daniel Noah, who runs this wonderful festival in the fall. Invited us
to I just saw him on 7852. I think he's participated in that movie.
So they invited us, and there the I think Glenn and I both thought, well, how can we maybe orient this towards where we're going? Mm-hmm. Certainly the Stanley Tales, the first one called Tales We Tell, is all about the hotel and a writer that goes there and is literally going to experience the inspiration of the old hotel, which inspired Stephen King. So and then Glenn wrote Speaking in Tongues for Montreal. It's in it's a bilingual. So
vraiment?
Ouais, absolument. Oui. C'est vraiment bizarre, ce truc-là. and as a result, I think we take inspiration, well, wherever you can get it. And then even Clay had written The Mattress King for the LA show. And even though it's a very New York story in terms mm-hmm. of it's about bedbugs.
Wait a minute. I take umbrage.
As one does write about bedbugs. But we actually...
They've got bedbugs.
We actually researched it, and we found that, oh, no, we can actually tell this tale in L.A.
We were delighted.
Mm-hmm. We were delighted to learn there's a considerable bedbug population in L.A.
But it seems as if Tales has had a kind of additional life, like the roadshow version of Tales, the woebegone kind of Harrison Keeler like live stage show where...
Yes.
You know, I feel like props to Daniel Noah and Landon Zackheim and all the people who kind of have experienced Tales at home or in their earbuds, then saying this has an additional kind of extra layer, which is the live version, and bringing that to all of these different festivals. And
Mitch Davis at Fantasia. Also.
Yeah.
April, are you working on some new ideas?
Oh, I am. I have many. Yeah.
Ooh,
whenever the guys want to go, I'm ready. It's a lot of fun, and it's the best thing I think about these tales is that it's not storytelling by committee, right? Mm-hmm. It's very much one writer, or if it's a co-writer, then it's two writers' vision. And Larry and Glenn are both very careful about making sure that they have notes and they have suggestions, but they it's very much the writer's property, and that's such a different experience, right? I don't know where else you can have that kind of an experience as a writer. So I have many ideas, and I love that these tales have kind of a shorter cycle often, so you can be a lot more responsive about what's going on right now and how you can it's one thing to make a 90-minute movie that is that responds to things that are going on, but it's much different and much easier in ways to do a 30-minute audio play about things. So it gives you a lot of flexibility, and it gives you an opportunity to really kind of look at things in a different way. So I'm ready.
I wonder what kind of horrifying things are going on today that you might
feel like
you
want
to respond to. None come to mind.
Yes.
I think we have basically all gone beyond the pale, and it's in a way it's a challenge. Like, how do we do something as fucked up as what's going on in the White House right now?
You can't try to compete with it, so all you can do is maybe respond to it.
But this is the thing about horror, is it's a way to speak about deeply unpleasant topics in a way that is still imaginative and creative and evocative of sort of a greater darkness, which is sort of always haunted humanity, and the fact that it's literally coming down on us. I think horror becomes a safe place.
Yeah, I was going to say, it always is a safe place. Yeah. I mean, it always has been for me, that sense of escapism, but it's interesting to see with Tales, I think there's some relevant themes in season 4.
Nice way to plug.
That are really speaking about what's going on.
Glenn
right
has a piece about a sort of a war criminal, sort of a Dick Cheney type, and I have
there are so many
little monsters that come out of the ground because of fracking fluid. They're
really?
Yeah, I always
environmental horror.
I always draw from environmental toxins.
Yes.
And actually, as inspiration. Yeah, and cold reading is
about
the dark, very dark story about sexual abuse.
Exactly. Uh-huh.
And yeah, Larry, you actually produced Night Moves, right? A couple years back.
Yes,
Kelly.
Well, that's right.
Yeah. More than a couple, maybe, but yeah.
Which but kind to of speak to April's point that these are things you can churn out, and they really can be sort of feel topical, and yet, of course, only good horror is timeless. And I think these are one thing I did want to say is that I've looked back on all my tales, and I realize how often I have monsters in them, which is so fun because it's obviously. You know, I don't use CGI for these monsters. It's all up to the audience. So it's kind of a retro element to it for me to have little creepy crawly creatures in one. We did one recently that isn't out yet, but where I had goblins that are flying around gondolas. And it's really fantastic. And, of course, April's has a Bigfoot. So it's just fun, the range of things that can go on in these tales, and they all live inside the imagination.
Folks should visit talesfrombeyondthepale.com and purchase, you know, there are up to now 4 seasons worth of audio plays you can order. But the most recent season 4 has just come out on this past Friday, the 13th. Let me thank everybody officially here, because this has been a complicated segment to do. But Larry did a sensational job co-producing, co-hosting. I appreciate it. So let me thank you, Larry, for doing that. And I also want to thank Clay McLeod Chapman, as well as April Snellings and Barbara Crampton, and, of course, my friend Glenn McQuaid for all participating in this very special episode. So thank you, everybody.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you. And April, you'll come back on again soon, okay?
I would love to. Thank you.
Sure. Okay. Bye, everybody. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Cheerio.